Genesis chapter 8, a new beginning after a long time drifting. We left off with Noah and his family on a huge boat set adrift on an endless sea. The 40-day storm had let up, but now 150 days and nights have passed, and still no sight of land. You have to wonder how Noah and his family were feeling by this time. God had kept his word about the animals and the flood, but after 5 months with water as far as the eye can see, you might start to worry. If you've ever felt like you're drifting and forgotten, like you keep waiting for the right door to open, but every door leads to all water and no land, this is a story for you. Let's start in at verse 1. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind blow over the earth, and all the waters subsided. And so our fearless crew was not forgotten after all, and the minnow was not lost. The first words of the chapter are, "But God remembered." Now, don't get the wrong idea here. It's not as if God had lost track of them on his giant to-do list. Let's see. Feed the fish. Check. Water the plants. Check, check. Wait a second. Noah. What happened to Noah? Thank God he is not forgetful in that way. The word remembered indicates that God kept remembering. Remember means to pay attention to fulfill a promise and act on it. Now, Noah may have felt forgotten, and you might too. If you do, and if you are his, remember that God has made a commitment to you. He will never leave you or forsake you. He will complete the good work that he began in you. God remembers you, and he never misses a promise. Noah's family was on the ark for months, but they were never forgotten. The waters began to subside, but this was a long process. In verse 4, "And in the 7th month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat." Now, Ararat is a mountain range in Turkey, and explorers from Marco Polo to the modern day have been convinced that they found the ark's remains. Right size, right location, and everything. Really, look around online and you'll see some amazing pictures and video. I don't know if it's the real deal, but it is interesting. In verse 6, Noah sends out a raven first, and then a dove, searching for signs of more land. Now, most of this chapter is slow progress, waiting on the right time, and perhaps waiting on the Lord. If you put all the times together, Noah's family was in the ark for just over a year. That's a long wait. But as long as we're all waiting out here in the ark, let's talk some more about evidence. The evidence for the flood covers history, paleontology, geology, and more. As for history, ancient cultures from Babylon to China to Mexico and literally every continent with people have a story of a great flood and of one family rescued in a great ship. The details vary, but they are all similar. Could it be that they're all based on the same true story? As for paleontology, a great flood is considered by many scientists to be the best explanation for many fossils. Animals that die in normal conditions don't make fossils. They decay. Fossils are created when something is buried suddenly in a catastrophe like a flood. And as for geology, there's a lot to cover, but I'll bring up two. Curiously enough, some of the tallest mountain peaks in the world are made of sedimentary rock, which is left by water, including on Ararat. And marine fossils are found all the way up on many high mountains. How did sea life get up there, and then get buried suddenly to create fossils? In fact, sedimentary rock and marine fossils can be found just about everywhere in the world, high or low. Why is that? Many geologists believe that it was a flood, regardless of what they think about the Bible. Now that was a fast review, so please research it if you want more. And one more thing, what about all those animals? How did they fit? And how did Noah take care of them all? For this, I'll recommend a book, Noah's Ark, A Feasibility Study, by John Woodmorap. If you can think of an ark question, the book likely covers it. One key to understanding here, you don't need every variation of animal, just two of each kind. Noah only needed 2 canines and 2 felines. And mutation and speciation would give us all the variety today. See, evolution does work on a horizontal plane, within a kind. It's verifiable and matches the Bible. Evolution on the vertical plane, one kind becoming another kind, is not observable, not verifiable, and not biblical. And I personally think it's just a bad theory. So with just 2 of each kind, estimates for the ark range from 16,000 to 35,000 animals. Mostly smaller than a sheep. And with over 100,000 square feet of floor space, the feasibility study works out nicely. All right, time to get moving again. After just over a year in the ark, the waiting is finally over in verse 15. Then God said to Noah, "Go out from the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you." So the door was opened at last, and there was land. Everybody out. Now that they are through, what is the lesson here? What is this whole story about, anyway? Certainly it is a judgment story, but there's more to it for Noah. Peter captures the core of the message in 2 Peter 2:5. If God did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. I love that verse. That is the heart of this story. The Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials, and he knows how to hold the unrighteous for judgment. Peter tells us that Noah's story answers two essential questions of life. Will God punish the wicked, and will God rescue the righteous? Yes and yes. Whatever the evil that you see around you, no matter how long it has gone on, God will punish the wicked. And whatever trial you are enduring, no matter how massive the storm, and no matter how long you set adrift feeling forgotten, the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials. Our God is a rescuer. He is a savior. The ark of wood saved Noah's life, and it is a cross of wood that saved mine. Jesus saved me from all the evil that swirled around me and in me. And just to make sure we make the connection to Jesus' sacrifice, check out the very first thing that Noah does after the ark. In verse 20, "Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar." This altar was likely for consecration, as in, "My life is yours now, God." Altars always seem to come at critical times in the Old Testament, and all of them should point us to the cross, the ultimate altar where the Son of God made the ultimate sacrifice. And watch carefully to see how Noah's altar affects God's heart. That same heart that was filled with pain over the violence of man, the heart that regretted ever making mankind. In verse 21, we see God's heart moved with compassion. As you read Genesis 8 today, do not imagine God as if he were some impersonal machine, callously exacting judgment on the wicked. Throughout the story, we are pointed to God's heart, a heart that grieves over man's evil, a heart that remembers his promise to Noah and keeps it, and a heart that is moved to mercy because of the altar. Noah came to the altar, just as we come to the cross, confident that we will find mercy. It is a fitting start to a brand new beginning.
Join us next time as we continue the journey, one chapter at a time. And remember, faith comes by hearing, and hearing through the Word.